A lot of churches in this country have found an update to an old saying, the Lord giveth and the bank taketh away. Lenders foreclosed on about 100 churches last year, which is a big increase from just a few years ago. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty looks at why.
A dozen years ago, Dan Burr and his wife started to worship with a few friends in their son's house in Fontana, California, about 80 miles from Los Angeles. Neighbors began to come. They brought their kids.
And it began to grow. Before we knew it, we had a little viable church.
Eventually, Crossroads Community Church bought a building of its own, a dilapidated boys' club that members fixed up themselves. Those were the glory days. Fontana was one of the fastest-growing cities in the country. Church attendance was booming, and Burr began to make big plans.
We were looking at vast tracts of lands and building family kind of community centers where there was both the church and there was daycare and there was youth centers and all kinds of things. And we were just really going to do this all. It was great. And then, bam.
The economic bottom fell out and members started losing their jobs.
First of all, 1 in 10 and then 1 in 8 and then 1 in 6 of our wage earners were out of work.
Church offerings dropped 20% to 25%. The church cut staff, trimmed programs to the bone, but finally it simply couldn't pay the mortgage. A year ago, it gave the building back to the bank. Now members are renting it until the bank finds a buyer.
We built up this building and just blood, sweat, and tears to turn a ratty old piece of land into a gorgeously landscaped thing with to just walk away from it. That's hard.
Houses of worship are subject to the same laws of economics as secular real estate.
Chris Mackey is a senior strategist at CoStar Group, which collected the data on church foreclosures. He says they went from a handful 5 years ago to about 100 last year. Most of the distressed churches are in the hardest hit real estate markets, California, Michigan, Florida. Mackey says churches were whacked by the same cross currents that flattened stores and other companies. Just as unemployed people resist buying new clothes or dining out, they put less in their church's offering plate. Add to that what Mackey calls recency bias. Churches had made plans and added debt in the flush years, believing the good times would continue to roll.
They were making decisions based on what had been happening and seemed reasonable, and unfortunately the downturn occurred and it affected them.
What made the problem acute this time, says Scott Rolfs at Ziegler, an investment banking firm that does church financing, was the easy credit in the mid-2000s.
There was a lot of money out there, and just as some home borrowers obtained mortgages that they probably shouldn't have gotten and wouldn't have qualified for under any other historical standards, you had a few churches with some overzealous lenders that ended up in that situation as well.
But he says God is not about to be homeless.
For 99% of the church going public in America, their church is coming through the recession just fine.
After all, there are more than 300,000 houses of worship in the U.S., so a few dozen foreclosures does not spell the end times. In fact, megachurches, which, like large companies, have bigger reserves, saw their income increase 3% last year. And for them, this is a time for a deal. Consider Triumph Church, a 10,000-member congregation in Detroit. Chief Ministry Officer Velva Flowers says a lot of their members worked for the auto industry and had to cut their offerings, but the church tightened its belt and drew new members, and those new members made up for the decline. Now, she says, the depressed market is working in their favor.
I believe because we have been cautious in our spending that we were able to take advantage of some opportunities that became available based upon the economic plight.
They're negotiating to buy a church that was foreclosed on for a song. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
Of all the government bailouts in the financial crisis, one of the most expensive was the rescue of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. The Obama administration had promised to offer a restructuring plan by today, but that plan has been delayed. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Before their takeover 2 years ago, Fannie and Freddie existed in a kind of gray area. Both were independent, for-profit companies that helped finance home mortgages. But investors always suspected if Fannie and Freddie got into trouble, the government would bail them out. That turned out to be correct, and Alex Pollack of the American Enterprise Institute says it was a recipe for trouble.
You can be a private company, and you might succeed and make a fortune, or you might go broke and lose everything. That's fine. Or you can be part of the government, but you can't be both at the same time.
The implicit guarantee of government help allowed Fannie and Freddie to funnel lots of money from investors into the ballooning housing market. Pollack says when the balloon popped, the investors were taken care of, but taxpayers were stuck with a big bill, more than $130 billion so far.
Ordinary American working stiffs are being taxed so that the bondholders can get paid off at par when they should be taking losses on the investments they made, but they won't.
There's widespread agreement now that Fannie and Freddie's model was broken, but there's plenty of disagreement about how much that contributed to the overall financial crisis and about what should come next, as Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said last summer.
It's safe to say there's no clear consensus yet on how best to design a new system, but this administration will side with those who want fundamental change.
The shape of that change is still forming 5 months later. Conservatives like Pollack say the government should generally get out of the business of bankrolling mortgages and leave most of that market to the private sector. But bond investor William Gross of PIMCO is skeptical.
Banks were the originators of these mortgages that went into Fannie and Freddie portfolios. And so to suggest that they can do a better job than Fannie or Freddie is certainly the pot calling the kettle black here.
Gross says he'd be reluctant to invest in mortgages that didn't have government backing unless the homeowners made down payments of, say, 30% or paid a significantly higher interest rate. Sarah Rosen-Wortel of the left-leaning Center for American Progress says without some government support, the classic 30-year fixed-rate mortgage would be out of reach for many families.
The home is still the place where families have been able to build up for their retirement, for their entrepreneurial opportunities, to pay for their kids' college. I'm not sure those opportunities would be there anymore.
Wortel proposes an alternative in which private capital would bankroll mortgages, but there'd also be a government insurance fund to guarantee those investments. Unlike Fannie and Freddie, the government would charge investors a fee to pay for that insurance, and it would only be available for high-quality mortgages, not the kind of so-called liar loans that were all too common during the housing bubble.
One lesson we've learned crystal clear is that we ought to be only supporting safe, secure, sustainable loans, that it's rational to assume homebuyers have the ability to repay.
The fight over Fannie and Freddie is part of a larger debate about the appropriate role for government in supporting the U.S. housing market. Right now, that market is still fragile and heavily dependent on the government-run giants for new home loans. PIMCO's Gross says whatever the long-term future of housing finance, the immediate future is likely to be as messy as the present.
It is definitely a food fight, and it will take time to resolve this, and cans will be kicked for several months at least, and maybe even several years.
The administration now says it will release its proposal for fixing Fannie and Freddie by mid-February. Scott Horsley, NPR News, The White House.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Today, Ford Motor Company announced its 2010 yearly earnings. The company made $6.6 billion in profits. That makes it Ford's most profitable year since 1999. Despite the good news, the numbers were not quite as rosy as many industry analysts had hoped. The company's stock actually fell today. And as NPR's Sonari Glinton reports, Ford still has a long road ahead.
Imagine for a moment that car companies were movies and the earnings season was the Academy Awards. The car Oscar ceremony would probably go something like this.
The nominees are General Motors, Ford Motor Company, and Toyota. And the envelope, please. I can never get these things open. With more than $8 billion, the winner is Ford Motor Company of Dearborn, Michigan.
Then enter the happy CEO, Alan Mulally.
Oh, it's fantastic.
That's probably how it would go, and it's sort of how it did when Ford announced its earnings today. Ford made over $8 billion before taxes and interest, and about $6.6 billion after. That means Ford employees will get profit-sharing checks, and it means it's been the best year for the company in more than a decade. Again, CEO Alan Mulally speaking in an interview.
You think about back then and now, this is a complete transformation of Ford.
1999 seems like a lifetime ago, and it was for the auto industry. It was before gas prices spiked, before the economic collapse, and before the deep recession. But while the whole industry had a tough decade or so, things turned out worse for Ford's competitors. Gary Bradshaw is a portfolio manager with Hodges Capital Management. He says Ford was able to capitalize on his competitors' misfortunes.
The consumer has come back in a big way at the time that, you know, General Motors has stumped their toe by going into bankruptcy, and that's left a sour taste in the consumer's mouth, and then the issues that Toyota had.
Bradshaw and others say Ford has been benefiting from a halo effect, scooping up customers that have fled the other automakers. They have streamlined, selling off foreign luxury brands and severely cutting dozens of vehicle brands. That reduced costs and added to the company's bottom line. But, and there is a but, Ford still has some problems. For example, Ford needs to attract more customers overseas, especially in China, where it sold only 500,000 vehicles. And instead of taking the bankruptcy route, Ford went into debt, a lot of debt. David Whiston is an investment analyst with Morningstar. He says that debt poses a problem.
Yes, their credit is less than ideal, and it's getting better, though, which is good, but it's not there yet. So they do pay a higher funding cost than, say, Toyota's.
Ford executives say they expect to pay off the debt this year. All the U.S. car companies have debt, but Ford also has a problem that GM and Chrysler don't have: union negotiations.
Ford is the only company that does not have a no-strike clause.
George Magliano is an analyst with IHS Automotive. Because of a deal cut with the government during bankruptcy, GM and Chrysler have no-strike clauses in their contracts with the United Auto Workers Union. Magliano says Ford's profits could put it in a tough negotiating position.
It is paramount that they get this union contract nailed down and get it nailed down peaceably.
Meanwhile, the investor Gary Bradshaw says Ford faces another potential problem: higher gas prices.
And that's going to weigh heavy on the consumer's mind again, and will he be buying the new F-150 trucks or the diesel trucks where, you know, they got better profit margins?
Bradshaw and the analysts agree that Ford is on its way to health. That is, if the economy doesn't get in the way. Sonari Glenton, NPR News, Detroit.
Eric Spiegel knows about corporate taxes. He's the chief executive officer of the Siemens Corporation. That's the U.S. division of the multinational engineering company Siemens AG that's based in Germany. Spiegel is traveling in Mexico, but he's found a few minutes to talk with us about the Obama administration's plans for corporate tax reform. Mr. Spiegel, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott, for having me on.
And first, let's understand the particular nature of your company. Is most of your corporate tax burden in the U.S. or Germany?
The U.S. is by far the largest market for Siemens. It's basically about a quarter, 25% of everything that Siemens does globally. And the company globally is well over $100 billion a year. So it's a pretty good-sized business here in the U.S.
And what's the difference in corporate tax rates between the U.S. and Germany?
I'm trying to think of the exact number, but it's substantially higher. I mean, I think the U.S. has the second or third highest corporate tax rate among developed countries.
Given the nature of the kind of business Siemens does, do you ever contemplate moving more of your assets out of the United States?
Well, it's a big issue. Since I've been in the CEO role for just over a year, I can think of at least several big decisions that looked at putting assets either in the U.S. or in Asia or in other parts of the Americas and or Europe. And, you know, when you run through the analysis of what these big investments cost and what the profitability of them is going to be, you know, corporate taxes obviously plays into the decision as to where you're going to locate these things. Despite the fact that we're a big player here in the U.S., there's no doubt that has limited to some extent businesses that we would put here if the corporate tax rate were lower.
It might be less a matter of you're tempted to relocate the assets you have here elsewhere than it's you don't want to put further assets here.
Yeah, I can think of at least a couple of cases where there was a decision not to put something here and put it somewhere else just because of the total economics. Now, whether the corporate tax rate alone would have swung the decision, I think in some cases it probably would. So, you know, we are building up new business. We've just added four or five new manufacturing facilities in the last year here because of a lot of the things that the president talked about in his State of the Union the other night. I mean, we've just broke ground on a new gas turbine plant in Charlotte, which is going to be aimed at not just the U.S. market but also export. Mm-hmm. We just are expanding our rail facility in Sacramento for light rail and medium speed rail. We just expanded our wind facilities or opened new wind facilities in Hutchinson, Kansas, and Fort Madison, Iowa. And those are all decisions based on the size of the market here. And I think this is a good time, by the way, the revitalization of manufacturing, it's starting now. In the first quarter of this year, our orders were up 23% and our sales were up 24%. And that's just a huge jump over last year. And we currently have 3,000 open jobs in the U.S. right now that we're trying to fill. And we're finding difficulty because a lot of those jobs are in engineering, science, and technology and things. But it really bodes well, given because we're a pretty good proxy for the U.S. We're in so many industries, including healthcare and most of the major industrial and oil and gas and energy and power. When our orders are up 23%, that typically means sales translates into sales about 18 months down the road.
Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, is going to be chairman of President Obama's Job Council. General Electric is, guessing, might even be your major competitor. Do you think he understands all this?
I'm on several committees and things in Washington with Jeff, and I think the good news about his appointment is I think he does understand a lot of these issues. I'm hopeful that he can have a positive impact on helping to get jobs moving again, and also to get some of these policies. I think once you get the policies in place, you'll get companies making investments, because investments require understanding the long term, not just putting some stimulus money in place or some investment tax credits. Those are short-term fixes. We really need some longer-term policies in place. And then, I think what I heard the president saying, we need to set a better environment for business here in the U.S. If we do that and everyone understands what the rules are, then you're going to see people make investments. Then the market will work.
Mr. Spiegel?
Yes.
Are you a little surprised to hear this proposal from a Democratic administration?
I have to admit, I've been in several events over the past couple of years where the president and other senior people from the administration have been in talking, and I've been at some of these meetings where people have raised the question of corporate tax, and it didn't get much discussion, I have to admit. I've heard a lot of people say that a lot of the things he said in his State of the Union were things he's been talking about for quite a while, but I think that this issue around the corporate tax rate and trying to find ways to reduce it, I think, is really something new that I haven't seen the administration engaging in, at least in the meetings that I've been in and some of the people I've been talking to. So I think that was definitely a change of course. I think the tone from the president sounded more pro-business than it has in the past. I think it's going to, the devil's going to be in the details. It's going to be all about the execution now.
Eric Spiegel, CEO of the Siemens Corporation, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.